Subscribe to the Writer's Block Podcast with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Some of the texts to Parker on Baseball Central, including a couple of folks who weighed in and suggest the people who were dumping on the Blue Jays were just aggrieved Leafs fans. Richard looking for something to do because there was no Leaf Zoom calls today.
I'm sure you talked a lot about it on Baseball Central. Apologies. I do listen a lot. I didn't today, but what a weird game yesterday. My God.
Yeah, that was one of those games. I mean, you would love this reference. You of all people would love this reference. Shulman said it was a bit like a WWE match, you know, where one guy's almost got the other guy pinned, then they get up, and then, you know, somebody rushes into the ring, and by the end of the night, you're looking at your scorecard and going, I don't know how that happened, but, you know, the big guy in the red tights is the guy holding the belt right now.
They call it in wrestling parlance, it's called false finishes. You know, you fake the audience out a number of times by thinking the match is going to be over, and then ultimately the match is over. But when they tied it up, I thought they were going to win. I thought for sure,
the
Marlins were going to throw it in. But, you know, Jeff, I know we have other things to talk about, but, as someone who's covered baseball for as long as you have, how does somebody like Rafael Dolis go from being, electric in the spring, quote-unquote spring, to, for lack of a better word, just very average, if not below average, when the games count.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is he wasn't really that good in the spring. But we never saw, you know, the body of Evan. When I say he wasn't that good, he looked like a guy that had been pitching overseas for a couple of years. So you know, you have to kind of allow those guys, give them a bit of rope. But I don't know. Making it more maddening is, you know, he had a couple of pretty good outings up to that point.
He did.
You know,
he appeared to have turned around.
And the bottom line here is this is with no disrespect meant to the Marlins, who more than any team in sports history perhaps would be well within their rights to just say to hell with 2020 and just walk off the field. The Jays showed a little too much respect to a bunch of guys. I'm glad Alvarez has an Olympic medal in speed skating. I'm very happy for him, but, you know, he's wearing number 65, 30 years old, making his major league debut and hitting seventh in the Marlins lineup for a reason. You know, you don't treat those guys with respect if you're a pitcher. But, yeah, I think it's become obvious this really is a development year now. You know, I'm looking at this, Richard, and the only thing I'm going to be focusing on by the end of the year is Nate Pearson by the end of the year ready to give me five innings, and five innings where I have a chance to win. I don't care if he strikes out three batters a game, give me five innings, hit 100 every now and then, have fastball command, all that good stuff, and does Vladimir Guerrero Jr. look, take some strides forward. That's kind of what I'm looking at right now. But
yeah,
the funny thing is, if that does happen, Richard, if that does happen, then they may have a shot at a playoff spot. That's probably the way to look at it.
The thing is, Joe, I totally agree with you. The reality is, based on the composition of how the league is this year, you know, they're going to be an outside playoff team. The reality is, Jeff, if this was 162 games, total developmental year, they're
absolutely,
they're flawed, but unlike the Maple Leafs, I feel like they're flawed and definitely going in the right direction. Like, you could see the makings of a winner, a consistent winner. And so you're going to have games like yesterday. And we talked about this from the beginning of this, for the way the road to the Blue Jays making the playoffs being a surprising team to make the playoffs was if Nate Pearson came in and was a dominant number two. That just hasn't happened. And, you know, like Ryu has been sort of hot and cold. And so all these things had to happen for them to be a realistic, you know, realistic playoff contender. Now, given there's so many teams, Jeff, in who will make the postseason, it's not impossible if they got hot for them to sneak in. I just think the schedule is not going to allow them necessarily. Like, you make a great point here. Like, if you're going to make the playoffs this year, like, you got to sweep the Marlins. Like, that's where you have a chance to move up. So, developmental year is not the worst thing. And I will tell you this. I think you've said this before. The best player on this team for years is going to be Bo Bichette. Like, he is just, to me, looks like a legitimate all-star player. And then I hope, you know, whether it's Cavan or Vladdy or Gurriel, I hope those guys develop sort of steadily every year. But man, do I like what I've seen from Bo so far.
Yeah, no, and you know, he's made three errors, and as Dan Shulman and Buck both pointed out, what you like to see when a guy does that is, does he have a short memory, right? Yeah. Will he make the next play? And Bo has done that. So, yeah, I'm with you. And again, if Vladdy turns it around and Nate Pearson becomes really good this year or improves this year, there is very much a chance that they have an outside shot at one of those playoff spots.
The one thing I would say with Vladdy, like, he's too young. First of all, you don't give up on him. You don't even think like that. There are historical antecedents, Jeff, where players with Vladdy's physique in every sport, like, the light clicks on. I'll give you a perfect example. One of the most famous NBA players in history, Charles Barkley, what was his nickname at Auburn? The round mound of rebound.
The round mound of rebound.
Right, because he was 300 plus. He did not care at all about physical fitness. He dominated. He didn't have to care about it. He was able to be great with his body. But if you remember, Jeff, when he went to Phoenix, he committed for like 3 or 4 years, like, to get in great shape, hired a trainer. He's one of the best players in the NBA for that stretch. Unfortunately for him, the Jordan Bulls were there and they didn't win. But maybe 24, 25, Vladdy Guerrero, like, the light kicks on. He uses that offseason to, like, work out, comes back in, like, kick-ass super shape, and who knows what the limit for this guy is. Because even now, like, you do see glimpses, Jeff. Like, even last night, like, that homer. You see glimpses still of the bat speed and, you know, what you ultimately expect from, what you hoped and expected from the guy who was the number one prospect in baseball not too long ago.
Yeah, and I will, I'll take it even closer. I'll bring it closer to home. And Raptors fans will know this. Anybody out there remember when there were concerns that Kyle Lowry was kind of that chubby little guy that killer? Seriously, I mean, that was one of the reputations Kyle Lowry had. So you're absolutely right. I think it's, and you know, let's face it, we've seen big guys in baseball who have had all-star seasons and very good careers, and they got tummies on them. I mean, I can't put it any other way. There are plenty of guys who certainly aren't. You know, they're not beach model, they're sculpted guys. Yeah. This just broke, I guess, just before we came in the air. This is from Tennis Canada, and I want to put this out there. Bianca Andreescu has withdrawn from the U.S. Open. Richard, is that a... I admit, there's so much going on. I haven't kept up in the status of the U.S. Open, but does this surprise you in any way?
It only is surprising because she had sort of indicated that she was going to go. It's at the end of the month. To me, if I was Bianca's handlers, agency, et cetera, I would pull her. The risk of heading to New York City to play in this incredibly odd event with no fans is not worth the reward, which obviously would be, obviously, let's say, winning and cash. I just think, Jeff, that given tennis has so many players from all around the world, it's going to be almost impossible to sort of quarantine them long enough to really be super safe. You got the sport hasn't really figured out yet exactly what the protocols are for COVID. Then on top of that, it's the travel. You know, travel to New York, travel from hotel. If you're Bianca Andreescu, I feel like just sit this one out. It's not worth it. I'm sure she's disappointed, but I think this is the right call.
Yeah, and I think that it's also it's a good year if you're an athlete and you have any reason to be uncomfortable with anything. It's a good year to sit out, and I don't mean that pejoratively. I'm just saying that. We'll talk to Bruce Feldman, college football reporter at Fox Sports later on about what is going on in college football. I said this at the start of the pandemic. I will say this until we have a vaccine at some point. I am completely on board with whatever decision any athlete makes at this time. I am completely on board with it. And I think we have to be that way.
And if you know Bianca specifically, Jeff, like she had a phenomenal year last year. Money at this point is probably not an issue. And, you know, if she invested wisely, she's already made multiple millions of dollars. You know, you play a global sport. And if you're going to compete on tour, you have to feel safe and confident that like each spot in the world that you go to is safe. And I think to me, the play here is caution. I will say though, you know, obviously somebody who's covered tennis and is a fan of the sport, for a lot of these players, it's gonna be a long stretch of not playing. You know, Nadal a couple months ago said he's not coming to the Open. Federer got hurt, so he's out for the year. Djokovic, I don't think has played since he actually contracted COVID with that absurd exhibition that he put on where he didn't do any kind of social distancing. So that sport in itself, Jeff, is going to be really weird because again, you're going to have some players who have not had a competitive match in like 7, 8, 9 months.
Well, and Serena's lost a whole year.
Yeah, well, she's back now.
Essentially,
so she's
playing.
Oh, is
she? Okay.
Yeah, she's playing against Venus today. In fact, in the 32nd or 33rd time the sisters have played.
So she has. Team? Is this team tennis?
No, this is sort of a, for lack of a better word, a warm up tournament for the U.S. Open.
Okay.
And so at the moment, she's committed to play. If you are sports like tennis and golf, Jeff, like one positive could shut it down. Like you gotta hope that nobody tests positive.
By the way, a reminder that we'll have a very short show tomorrow because we have the a Raptors game that we're carrying live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. The Raptors last night, their bench beat the Sixers bench 125-121. It was funny watching. I don't know what impression you're being left with, Richard, but you know, and we're going to be joined later on by Sarah Kustik, the NBA analyst with the Brooklyn Nets, and we'll talk about the life in the bubble and not life in the bubble, but guys we've seen emerge in the bubble, you know, guys like Devin Booker and I mean, Damian Lillard has become a great story in it. But, you know, one of the things I've started to realize watching this is I think the bubble is going to change the way a lot of people around the NBA perceive some players. Kyle Lowry looks like the type of guy you'd invite over for a backyard barbecue in this bubble. Just the way he's been engaging with his teammates. And I'm not saying that isn't the case all along. But we're seeing a lot of personality, Richard, come out on the guys who aren't playing the games. And some, you know, the Patrick Beverley thing I thought was a little, you know, that was kind of a kick in the groin to Damian Lillard. But, hey, you know, what? I'm sure Damian's a big enough guy that he can handle that. But we've seen kind of a different angle to some of these guys, which I really like.
Yeah, first of all, don't piss Damian Lillard off is maybe rule one of the bubble because he's going to go off on you. You know, this is something Jonesy said that that I really liked. He said watching Kyle Lowry and Serge Ibaka, Marc Gasol, guys like that, so into the games of the reserves playing, like affirms the Raptors culture. Like it's so reflective of like what they've built there that the starters are so into seeing the bench guys get some minutes. And like the reality of this, Jeff, like this is, you know, people would say, you know, it's the bench guys. It's not an insignificant game. I understand all that. But you know what? Like whether it's Matt Thomas or certainly Chris Boucher, like, there's probably going to be a guy who's going to come in to one of these games that matter because of foul trouble. And this, like, 20, 30 minutes that they got during some of these late games in this lead-up, I think could prove valuable. Just it has kept them sharp. But yeah, it's fun to see guys like Lowry on the bench and just sort of dressing up and laughing. There's a real camaraderie with NBA players. I feel like they're really like, how do I sort of say this? Like, and this is not to say that other guys wouldn't do this, but I always get the impression with a lot of NBA guys, including stars, that like if they were just driving by a basketball court and had nothing to do, they'd like get out of the car and watch the game because they're like into the sport that much. Like they just love the game. And maybe that's like for all sports. You know, I think like a guy like Tom Brady might do that, but I think there are other guys who just sort of can take it or leave it. But I always feel like the NBA guys they're like really into basketball. And so that's what this bubble has sort of shown me.
Right. One of the stories to come out of last night's game as well, of course, was the Raptors letting Adrian Griffin, Nick Nurse letting him coach the game, which was, again, in terms of how the Raptors relate to their folks, you know, is going to, I think it's going to show people again just sort of how all in the Raptors are. And everybody in their organization, of course. We are waiting, Richard, the release of or a release from the Raptors regarding some allegations of domestic violence that were made against Griffin.
By his ex-wife.
Yeah. By his ex-wife on social media. And I don't know when the tweet first came out. But it's something I know that Michael Grange has reached out to the appropriate parties, and I know that we're led to believe the Raptors will have a comment on this. So we'll await the outcome of that. But certainly Nick Nurse making a statement there, if we operate under the assumption this was done with the very best of intentions, Nick Nurse made quite a statement, I think.
Yeah, Jeff, just to, again, these are allegations and, you know, how do I sort of phrase this? Sort of like the story will sort of move itself forward, and we will ultimately learn the veracity of these allegations or the lack of veracity of these allegations. But it's a really bad story for the Raptors at this moment, given just how sort of perfect things have gone inside that bubble. They also, to me, are the quintessential non-distraction team, and they don't bring that upon themselves. So again, the allegations were made. They were made publicly by Adrian Griffin's ex-wife. From doing a very bit of quick research, it's not the first time she's made them. So the allegation is not sort of coming out like immediately after he coached this game. So the Raptors, let's just be blunt, Jeff. It's not a situation they want to be in. It's not going to be an easy situation to navigate. And they're going to have to do some investigating regarding this allegation. The one thing that usually, Jeff, that these sort of you learn a little bit from these stories, and I have colleagues at The Athletic who report on this all the time, is organizations that try to sweep this away quickly, it never works. You should try to be as transparent as possible when you can be. And other than that, we really can't make any speculation, but if the allegations are true, it's awful. It's awful. It's awful all around in so many different ways.
Right. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it is incumbent on the Raptors to investigate and address this situation.
Yeah.
And, this is an organization that has seldom put a foot wrong.
Correct.
And it gives me an inordinate amount of confidence that whatever decision is reached, it will be reached as a result of a very thorough investigation. And one thing you know about Masai Ujiri, he is very good at asking pointed questions.
I am a cynic for the most part, Jeff, when it comes to internal organizations from sports organizations. And I quite frankly believe that, like, that cynicism has been earned by too many organizations. Mm-hmm. Not to come off like a homer, but I have belief that the Raptors will investigate something like this with honesty, with intelligence, with thoroughness. And I think that's just what their organization represents.
Yeah, and you know, and if they do, and you know, they find that they are that they're comfortable with their findings, you know, then I think again, I just at the instant it happened, and not knowing, of course, the allegations that were going to come out, and admit I don't know. I've talked to Adrian Griffin. I think we may have had him on the show. I don't know him that well. But my first reaction was, boy, that really reflects well on Nick Nurse and the organization that they're letting this guy have a run and coach the team, you know, in a nationally televised situation. But you're right. We'll wait and see. We'll wait and see what develops from the Raptors investigation. But I think we're also both on the same page that if there's an organization that's going to do this right, it's probably the Raptors.
Yeah, no, I have faith. I don't think these guys are the Mavericks. I don't think these guys are the Redskins.
Nope.
Like
I'm sorry, the
Washington football team. My bad.
you don't even have to call. Don't even have to use that word anymore.
Yeah.
Bruce Feldman is Fox Sports college football reporter. This story has fascinated me for a variety of reasons. Most importantly, I think just Richard. This sums up the politics of COVID in the United States, I think, on a geographical basis, on a regional basis, on a political basis. How this story is unwinding sums up a lot of that. There's also an interesting article written in The Guardian in the UK by one of their North American sports reporters that talked about whether or not the decision on the part of some leagues to cancel football might not be an attempt to nip in the bud some of the unionization movements we're seeing.
Yeah,
I think
I read
it's a little draconian, but it's certainly the timing is interesting.
Yeah.
Bruce Feldman joins us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Big Ten and Pac-12 presidents have voted to postpone the 2020. A bunch of other conferences, or a couple of other conferences at least, are looking at spring football. Richard, we talked about this a lot in recent weeks, just kind of following it. I mean, this is a strange time for college football. You know, between the COVID-19, between the pandemic, essentially shutting down colleges, let alone college football in a lot of instances, you know, coupled with the fact that these are players who don't receive any, I mean, they're not playing for salaries, you know, and now coupled with the fact that there is, at least in some corners of the college football world, a move to, I'm going to use the phrase unionize. I don't know if that's necessarily the appropriate phrase. Certainly a move towards creating an association of players to allow players to regain or to gain control of some matters as it relates to the game, to regain some control that in the past they haven't had. Of course, you've already seen some movement made in terms of players and their ability to monetize their rights. It's like the college football world, the administrative part of the world has just been turned upside down by this whole thing.
It's and then Jeff, we haven't even got into, I'm sure we'll get into with Bruce, just the whole politicization of this issue. It's college football in so many states that are quote unquote red states in the United States, conservative leaning. It's it may be the most powerful force in those states, to be just very blunt. And so it's not just the canceling of seasons or the potential canceling of seasons is not just a sports issue. It crosses over into popular culture. And obviously, right, we've already seen the major announcement of the Big Ten not playing football this year. And, you know, that's Michigan and Ohio State and Wisconsin and Michigan State. I mean, these are programs that are competing in college football for, you know, 80, 90, 100 years. Major story in the United States.
Bruce Feldman is college football reporter with Fox Sports. He joins us in Writer's Block. Bruce, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us. As we sit here right now, and Richard and I have talked about there's a sort of a geographical element to this particular story. As we sit here right now, who do you expect will be playing football, college football, in the fall?
Well, it, as you guys said, it's a very fragmented, very regionalized sport. There is no centralized leadership, unlike pretty much everything else. And as you've said, these guys aren't professionals. So they're, if you're going to play football, it's not like it's going to be baseball where there can be elements of social distancing. You can't do that with football. And the rosters are way bigger in college football. And the teams or sizes are so much bigger. So, and they're on campuses where you run the risk of spread. And even the people who are optimistic, and the most optimistic people I've talked to in my reporting have been folks in the SEC and in the Southeastern Conference, I think their biggest concern is what happens when the regular students come back to campus and there's going to be a surge of cases. Because if you look around, no matter how optimistic you are, there are significant numbers of cases in a lot of those states. And so having said all that, you know, as you guys said, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten made big decisions to say, hey, we're going to make the determination we cannot press forward to try to have football seasons, at least in the fall. I don't know, you know, 2 weeks from now, maybe even a week from now, if there's going to be any of the major college football conferences still clinging to the hope of playing. Right now it's the Big 12. They made the determination yesterday that they were going to press forward. The ACC and the SEC are going to do it. And we'll see what happens going forward. I will say this. We did a big story that I worked on for much of this week at The Athletic about the medical information that was passed down to the Pac-12 by their medical experts. And we're talking about, it's over 20 people, and a lot of these people are at the top of their field. And they had a Zoom meeting with the coaches, the ADs, as well as the commissioner. And it was chilling for a lot of these coaches to have a lot of football coaches scared for what they were hearing because of the concerns of myocarditis and heart issues, especially, not to mention the problem they have that there's just not enough testing in some of these hotspot areas. That really made change minds, and it was kind of a game changer for them. If that gets to that point, and again, you can see it in the story that we did today, where one of the coaches had said to me, these other conferences, they're not seeing the presentation we got on Monday night. And so, or they don't want to see it. And I think that's the part that's pretty chilling about this.
Mm. Bruce, what would it mean for the sport at large, for the sport writ large, if the SEC, let's sort of just say the SEC and the ACC play this year, and then you have the other three parts of the Power Five conferences decide not to, or maybe it's the Big 12 and the SEC and the ACC. Like what, you know, it's such a almost seemingly inconceivable thing to think about, but what does it mean if half of the Power Five plays and the other half of the Power Five decides not to play in the fall?
Then the national champion, if it can get to the finish line, will be determined by those two leagues probably. Or maybe if the AAC, which is not in the Power Five, but it's still an FBS conference, which has Houston and UCF and programs at that level, will try to make a case that they deserve a spot in a playoff bid. It would be on a lot of levels kind of surreal to see no, as you mentioned, Ohio State, Penn State from the Big Ten, or a USC, which is a Pac-12 program, or Oregon, which is really talented. But at the same time, I think people would adjust, and it would be crazy. And look, there's those two conferences, as well as other conferences that have said they can't try to play in the fall, are trying to be optimistic, and I use those words cautiously, trying to be optimistic that they would be able to play college football in the spring. So I don't know. I mean, look, if those conferences feel that they can safely press forward, I'm sure the TV ratings would be sky high because there'd be such a void of college football that fans would watch. You know, at this point, it seems very dicey to me, not only that they're going to play, but the fact that Oklahoma can say right now, we think we could have 25% capacity at games. And You just feel like, wow, because we're not even seeing in the places that have had bubbles, the NBA, NHL, they're not fans there. So now the idea that they could do that, we'll see. I got my fingers crossed, but right now there's a lot of people who are very nervous around the sport.
Bruce, one of the things that kind of interests me about the timing of all this, and I don't pretend to know how how significant or how far along the unionization of student athletes is, and I'm using that in quotation marks, how far along that has gotten in U.S. college football. But it seems to me that one of the positives for college football administrators here is that this might slow down the move towards, again, I'm going to use the word unionization. The old theory that sometimes a crisis is too good an opportunity to let pass. Now, I understand there's a huge financial hit that would be taken here. But what type of an impact will this have in that move? Or is that move something that simply, intrigues those of us in the media, but really doesn't have that much of a groundswell of support?
I think, as somebody had put it to me, who is in business around college football, but not an athletic director, not a commissioner, said, having been versed with this as it kind of happened in the Players Tribune and started to roll out in the Pac-12, was this is a media story looking for a constituency. And I think one of the things that, I'm not saying I wouldn't take it seriously, but one of the things that I think maybe some folks who will get excited about it on social media, maybe they've not reading the room on this, in terms of one of the driving forces behind it is a former UCLA player who had been a driving force behind a unionization movement at Northwestern 6 years ago that got a lot of attention, but there really, it was a little bit of a hollow horse in terms of there wasn't as much to it as people wanted to believe. And then he had been behind a story a few months ago that, again, also a lot of people I talked to who were involved with it said it felt like a little bit of a bait and switch, and what are we being pushed up for? And so I'm a little skeptical. It's not to say that there can't get traction for this, but I think there's just so many other issues that are going on that it's hard to see that this is going to go forward anytime soon, because, as you said, the monumental hit that could come for around college athletics, and I'm not even talking about like the businesses connected to college athletics, and I'm talking about like if you're in a college town and there's restaurants and hotels and all these things that are going to be devastated because they're not going to have any fall and what it means to those things. But I'm talking about just the universities as they are. It's going to be crippling to them what would happen if there is no college football in the 2021 academic year.
Bruce, obviously you're doing a show right now that's based in Toronto, heard throughout Canada, and I don't know how many people sort of are familiar with the nexus between college football either being played in the fall or postponed and the current political situation in the United States, where there are a lot of politicians, and particularly politicians who are Republicans in very conservative states, putting at least a lot of public pressure on universities to play. And, of course, the president of the United States has not made any secret of being very public about him wanting college football to start. Can you, from your own perspective, I'm not sure this has ever come up before for you in terms of just how political the sport has become, and what kind of impact has the politics of COVID-19 had on the politics of college football right now?
Right. It's a messy story that's gotten exponentially more thorny and messier because of some of that. And I don't know how versed any of the people who make their living in Washington, D.C. are on these issues. They may say they're a fan of the school from the state they're in, but it's a clown show when you start to look at some of what they bring to the table on these issues. And I think that's the part where it's like, I don't know, say you want to take it with a grain of salt because it can get momentum and it can push people into corners and everything like that. But where are some of these people, you know, I had this conversation with an AD at a pretty big school, and we talked about the potential road of accountability if something really bad is happening here. And I think that's the thing that a lot of, I would not want to be an athletic director right now, and I definitely would not want to be a college president, because you're staring at some, never mind the potential long-term, and this might be not fair to even count this, never mind, but like there is looming litigation that could be hanging over college athletics in a profound way as it relates to some of these issues, right? And they're the ones who are going to be the ones who likely are going to be way more accountable than some of these politicians who are doing drive-bys as it relates to this. And that's the part that I think has made it more complicated and messier. And I think that's the part that you kind of cringe at, where, you know, with the Pac-12, again, I don't think any of these politicians have heard the presentations and the PowerPoint that we wrote about today at The Athletic that the Pac-12 coaches got and the Pac-12 ADs got. And now, does that mean that they stop playing, and if the SEC feels like, all right, well, we're kind of backed into a corner, but we're going to try to play, and hopefully, fingers crossed, there are no issues that they run into. There are no players who have end up with significant heart issues. There are no tragic stories. And so we're not just talking about players, by the way, because they're 18 to 22. We're also talking about, there's a lot of football coaches. Nick Saban's the most famous football coach in college football. He's almost 70, right? And so there's a lot of coaches who are also, or staffers, who are also potentially at risk here. And again, like I said, it makes it much more muddled, and you know, you just kind of, every day feels like it's a week as it relates to how this story collectively unfolds in a very regionalized sport where the politics, as you mentioned, are very charged, and it's a very polarizing environment here.
Bruce, good stuff. Thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Take care. Bruce Feldman of The Athletic and Fox Sports College Football Reporter. It's going to be a fascinating story. And Richard, yeah, you're right. It is. There are great wide swaths of the United States where this is the sports story right now.
And then, Jeff, you know, the thing Bruce didn't even mention, and I'll mention now quickly, this is all coming during what? During a presidential election.
Election.
The most politicized presidential election of people's lifetime.
Oh, yeah. The president's been tweeting about this. So the president's been tweeting about a lot. Sarah Kustok is the Brooklyn Nets NBA analyst on Fox Sports and the YES Network. We know that the Nets will take on the Raptors in the first round of the playoffs. The Nets have a pretty big game tonight, too. They can have a say in who gets into that Western play-in against the they'll take on the Portland Trail Blazers tonight. Sarah Kustok joins us next. Writer's Block continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Welcome back to Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Jeff Passan, MLB insider with ESPN, joins us at 4 o'clock. Ren LaVoir, NHL insider with TVO Sports. Of course, the breaking news out of the NHL bubble. Claude Julien, the head coach of the Montreal Canadiens, was taken to hospital with chest pains following last night's game. He's been kept under observation. According to Elliot Friedman, the Canadiens are saying this is not related to COVID-19. But they are saying he won't be back behind the bench before the series ends. So Kirk Muller will take on head coaching duties. And again, Ren LaVoie, who covers the Canadiens and the NHL for TVS Sports, joins us at 4:25. So we'll get the very latest on that. Well, we know this much about the Toronto Raptors. The Toronto Raptors are going to be facing the Brooklyn Nets in the first round of the playoffs. It always seems to come down to Brooklyn. That will be the case again this year. The Nets, though, play a game tonight that probably doesn't have – there's not much in it for them, but, boy, for the Portland Trail Blazers, it's the biggest game. It's the biggest game of the bubble. Sarah Kustok is Fox Sports and Yes Network's Brooklyn Nets analyst. She joins us on Writer's Block. Sarah, thank you so much for doing this today. As I said, it kind of figures that at some point the Nets and Raptors are going to meet in the playoffs. In the past, that would send shivers down the spines of Raptors fans. I'll just ask you, before we talk about the bubble and what we've seen, this matchup, you know, do the Nets have enough firepower to match up with the Raptors? I mean, at the end of the day, that would be my first question. Everything else aside, strategy, everything else aside, I don't know if they have the firepower to match up with this team.
Yeah, thrilled to be on with you guys. And I wish that this playoff series was taking place where we got to saw the incredible electric atmosphere that exists, especially at Scotiabank Arena and in Brooklyn. You know, the Brooklyn Nets have faced so much roster attrition going into the bubble. I don't think any of us would have anticipated that they would have played and gelled as well as they have, given the new pieces that they've added, so many two-way players. And those that had spent time with the Long Island Nets getting significant time while down in Orlando. And they played really well. They, you know, so much of what they've done has been an unselfishness and, you know, just their chemistry they've shown. However, I think anyone would admit that they do not have the talent that exists on the Toronto Raptors roster. And, you know, you look at what the Raptors are, the championship DNA that they have in them, and just the fact that you guys are now whole at this point of the season, given the performances that you had throughout the course of the early part of the season, still sitting where you were in second place. It is certainly going to be a monster of a challenge for the way the Brooklyn Nets roster looks at this point.
First, Sarah, good to hear your voice. Been a while. Thank you for coming
Richard,
on.
Absolutely.
So okay, if you could create your own blueprint, if you're the Nets organization of how you see a potential route to pull this off. Let's say just outside the Raptors just going cold for 3 or 4 nights or something like that. What is the potential route for the Nets to pull off this upset? What has to happen?
First you say that, and the thing about the Raptors, and you guys know this better than anyone, just the depth that exists within this group. And I think more often than not, and maybe see a little bit of this throughout the course of the games in Orlando, but teams may overlook and take for granted, looking across the bench, looking at a roster that doesn't have a lot of their key players. I don't see that in this Raptors group. I see them coming ready for bear and a respect level to the game and to their opponent, regardless of who it is, because of what they have in mind. And so, you know, I think for the Nets, where they have thrived is the ability to play fast and when they have been efficient from the three-point line. A lot of their offense has come from the fact they're sharing the ball really well. They've had high assist numbers, low turnovers. Those, I think, are the formula in terms of any wins. But I think if there's anything, it's going to come down to some hot shooting and the ability to defend this Raptors team. And that's been an area for the Nets where they have really struggled. They're switching more. They're doing a nice job so far of being more aggressive in the different looks and the different things they're throwing at teams. But to me, I look at a Raptors group that has seen just about every defense and understands the nuances of the playoffs and to expect adjustments, expect different looks. And that's what I think is concerning when you look for the Nets at this matchup against a team like Toronto.
Now, we don't know what the offseason will look like in terms of finances, but it appears to me that a guy that some Raptors fans will probably be paying particular attention to is Joe Harris. I'm just wondering where his game is right now and sort of where would you rank him right now with the potential, again, understanding that we don't know what the offseason is going to look like, with potential free agents who will be available?
I would put him, you know, in one of the top bunches of the list, just because what do you want out of a player? A knockdown three-point shooter. I mean, that's a attribute that any team always covets. And Joe Harris is playing the best basketball. I know these are different circumstances, but some of the best basketball that I have seen him play throughout his career, and has shown an ability when, you know, he's been an excellent number three, number four option for this team at different times, but he's been one of the top guys. And those around the league have known him as a three-point shooter. You know, just two seasons ago, led the league in three-point shooting, won the three-point shooting contest, has been consistent in that area. He's added so much to his game, driving a closeout, his ability to finish, working in an intermediate game, how he's improved on the defensive end, excellent court vision and passing skills. And so for the Nets, and Sean Marks, you know, the general manager, has said that his number one priority is keeping Joe Harris. However, I think, you know, when it comes to free agency, the amount of money and what teams are going to be looking at to find a player that has a skill set of Joe, and just, you know, on top of that skill set, the character he brings, he is team first, willing to do anything that's asked of him. So he's someone, if I was any team in the league, I would certainly have my eye on.
So I got one last quick one for you. The Nets are fascinating. And I think it just makes for you and I and Eagle, who I've written this many times, I think are the best regional broadcasters that exist in the NBA. It's like a national broadcast regionally. Next year is going to be insane, because, like, I think people have short memories and they forget Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant is coming back, presumably healthy. Kyrie Irving is coming back, presumably healthy. So you could be broadcasting a team that I think is going to go out fairly quickly in the first round to a team that, like, would have a legitimate argument to be an Eastern Conference champion next year. That has to be, as a broadcaster, just very surreal for you, no?
It's crazy to wrap your head around. And I think you said it best, and that people forget, you know, in some ways, Brooklyn Nets fans certainly haven't, but that, okay, Kevin Durant is a part of this team, even though he had not suited up. Kyrie Irving was injured for so much of the season, but just not having seen him play now for 16 or so months, wherever we're at, the talent he is, the score he is, how he changes the entire dynamic of what a team is, and these complementary pieces for the Nets team, and we don't know how anything is going to look, but that have developed so quickly due to the type of experience that they've had in this role. It really is. I think there's so much uncertainty, it goes without saying, across the board, not only, you know, in this world, but also in the NBA and just how things will shake out. But I do think just it's starting to imagine that, starting to put the pieces together, starting to see what that opportunity for the Nets organization may look like, given that type of star power, is something that's exciting.
I know we just have you for another minute here, Sarah. I do want to ask you, what does Damian do tonight?
Oh, I don't know. Does he go off for 60 again? I think, you know, I think you guys said it best. And Jeff, when you're opening, this game for Portland is everything. And Damian Lillard had shown he could be everything. So
absolutely.
I don't know. It's going to be fun.
Thank you, Sarah. Take care. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, guys.
Sarah, be well. Sarah Kustok, NBA analyst, Fox Sports and the YES Network, the Brooklyn Nets. They will be the Raptors' first-round playoff opponent. Jeff Passan of ESPN will join us. The bubble's working in the NHL and the NBA. Could it be coming to Major League Baseball, to the playoffs? I think it absolutely will be coming to Major League Baseball, to the playoffs. Jeff Passan, Ren LaVoie, Writer's Block continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Listening to Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
That 14-11 loss to the Miami Marlins last night. The Tampa Bay Rays will roll into Buffalo. It still seems strange to say that. We'll roll into Buffalo tomorrow for a weekend series. They're playing the Red Sox. I believe that game starts in a couple of minutes today. Lots of talk around baseball in the past couple of weeks or so about the possibility of the game using a bubble format for its postseason. Now, if you remember correctly, at the very beginning of this whole process of baseball attempting to play during the pandemic, one of the ideas that was floated was that of a couple of bubbles, or I guess centralized location for teams to play games in Arizona and Florida in particular, were the two areas that were focused. That soon died when it seemed to become apparent that there wasn't a tremendous amount of appetite in the part of the players for that. I don't know, frankly, how committed the owners were. I still don't know how committed the owners were to necessarily playing a baseball season. But Jeff Passan of ESPN reporting that is very much on the table for the postseason. We'll bring Jeff Passan in right now. Jeff, thanks for joining us. As always in Writer's Block, my reaction to that story was, why the hell wouldn't you do it? Because, you know, we can argue about how goofy it looks to have, virtual fans or, you know, how goofy some of the things the NHL and the NBA have done. But you know what? They're getting their business done. They're not getting a lot of tests. Yeah, there's bitching on the part of players about the quality of the sandwiches and that, but that has kind of dissipated. Like, to me, it seems like a no-brainer. The only question I would have is, if you were going to go with the bubble format, wouldn't it make sense to do it in a place where you have a retractable roof so you could at least have some guarantee against weather?
Yeah, either that or in a location like Southern California where the weather is just always good. And I think that ultimately is where baseball is going to land. It feels much more to me, Jeff, like an NHL type format than it does the NBA, where you're going to have probably in the end one hub city, but maybe at the beginning of the playoffs, two hub cities. They don't know at this point if they do go down this bubble track, which I do in the end think they're going to. They don't know if they're going to do it starting after the wild card round, starting with the wild card round. Like, there are a lot of balls up in the air at this point, but I think there is an appetite, certainly from Major League Baseball, to do this, and a recognition from the players that doing it for a month is a whole lot different than for the 4 or 5 months that they would have done it, had they pursued this from the start. And so it will really surprise me if they make it to October and it's not in some sort of a bubble type format.
Jeff, you know, there's a lot of metrics to determine, like, the popularity of a sport. viewership is obviously a big one. Attendance is a big one. We don't really have attendance right now for Major League Baseball, so we'll use viewership as an example. And in a lot of places, a lot of cities, the regional numbers are up, and in some cases up pretty good. The national numbers started very good. They've dropped a little bit, but it's not a disaster by any means. How do you think Major League Baseball feels right now about the product, the on-field product, in relation to what the consumer is seeing?
The product right now, Richard, is really weird, actually. We're seeing baseball played almost in a different way than we ever have before. And I've got a story coming out today that illustrates a few of these things. And it's almost a reflection, I think, of what the pandemic has done writ large. We look at the acceleration of what was likely to happen, whether it's in business, whether it's in politics, or in this case, in sports. And I say that, let's use an example of the designated hitter coming into play. There are fewer, by a long shot, pinch hitting, not just opportunities, but usage of pinch hitters than there have ever been. The sacrifice bunt is dead. There have been, I think there have been 18 plus thousand plate appearances in the baseball season thus far, and 26, I think, sacrifice bunts. Like, the sacrifice bunt rate is down 66% from last year, when I believe it was at an all-time low already. So, batting average, you know, listen, sacrifice bunting and pinch hitting are small parts of this. Batting average right now, guys, is lower than it was in 1968. And after 1968, Major League Baseball lowered the mound by 5 inches because they thought that it was too advantageous to pitchers. So the game itself looks different right now, and it almost looks like a cartoonish version of what we've seen coming over the last few years, where velocity matters when it comes to fastballs, and where they're being thrown, fastballs, I mean, at a lower rate than we have ever seen before. I mean, right now, this is a fact, there are more off-speed pitches thrown in a baseball game than there are fastballs. And it's been trending toward that. I think last year it was 52.5% fastballs. This year, I think it's 49.6%. And the way that the game was moving has only been accelerated and exacerbated, I think, by the shortened season.
Yeah, it's fascinating hearing you, you know, hearing you give out those numbers, because Ross Atkins did a conference call with, or a Zoom call with reporters a couple of days ago, and one of the questions he was asked, and I think it was Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet asked him about it, is, okay, as we get close to the trade deadline, how exactly are teams evaluating players? And his point was, you know, for example, if you're a team that falls out of it and you've got a guy that you want to trade to another team and you're looking to get a couple of minor leaguers in return, how do you judge that? These guys aren't playing. You know, and
Jeff, that's such an interesting point, because in my story that's going to be posting today, I ask that exact question and take it one step further. Is the trade market, because of the 16 teams that are going to be in the playoffs this year, as well as the lack of concrete information on some of the prospects you would get, going to be a disaster? Is it going to be just, is it going to look like an NFL trade deadline as opposed to what the typical MLB trade deadline looks like, with a flurry of trades? And I don't know if you saw this, but earlier today, Kylie McDaniel, our great scout at ESPN, reported that MLB has a video exchange program from the alternate sites where a lot of these prospects are, that it's starting up now. As a team, you can either opt into that or opt out of it. And I don't believe that all the teams have opted in or will opt in. But, you know, with scouts banned from going and watching baseball, and with nobody really except team personnel having their eyes on these alternate sites, it makes the construction of a trade extraordinarily difficult. And beyond that, there's the whole fact that we have no idea whether the season's going to be finished. You could trade for a guy today, and tomorrow there's a massive COVID outbreak in the sport, and Rob Manfred says, peace out, we're shutting this whole thing down. And all of a sudden, you've given up a prospect for what? For a game? For right. 5 days? Like, that is, for an industry that is as risk-averse these days as Major League Baseball teams are, the calculus of that disincentivizes it significantly, and again, makes me think that we're just not going to see a whole lot of big trades coming up at the August 31st deadline.
You know, one of the other points that Ross Atkins made, too, and I hadn't thought of this, and I don't think he was making it as to say this was a one-size-fits-all thing, But as he said, you know, one of the things we know about our game right now is age is very much a factor when you look at making a deal. And if you are talking about someone who's effectively lost a year, well, that's going to make a difference. You know, we can sit here and say that, well, there's no difference between someone who's 24, 25, 26, 27. But you know what? There is in the way they're valued. There is a difference in that. And that's what, you know, makes me think that, like, I don't know, will analytics be even more of a role now, play even more of a role now? Will you have guys digging back to, you know, look at swing paths and bat speed and stuff like that and base decisions on that as much as anything else?
The problem with that, Jeff, is that year over year, month over month, those things change.
Right.
And I suppose that the video element of it is sort of the best you can do in this situation. But so much decision making in baseball these days involves multiple elements. It involves video scouting. It involves in-person scouting. It involves makeup scouting, and it especially involves analytics. And while it's nice to have video of someone and to look at him and say, this is what I see from this guy, this is what our analysts see from this guy, if you don't have concrete numbers to back it up, the strength of your decision the strength of your evaluation just is not going to be at the level that you're used to. And if you feel 50% confident in the value of your analysis, when you're normally 80, 90, 95% confident based on all of the different metrics that you have pouring into this, you know, delicious soup of analysis, it's going to be difficult to pull the trigger on something like that when you just, like, analysis of a player is hard enough to begin with. Analysis of a player when you don't have all the data points that you're used to feels like a fool's errand.
Jeff, I realize that you have to cover the entire league, so asking about specific teams you're not going to see the Blue Jays as much as we do. You know, plus the last time we talked to you, you were in the Ozarks. Who the hell knows how much you've been paying attention to anything, quite frankly. But Jeff Blair and I were talking earlier in the show today about sort of an evaluation of the Blue Jays, and he made a really great point that, like, it really has become a developmental year, even though it seems like they're going to hang around close enough where the fan base can sort of still dream about the playoffs. From your perspective, at least the amount of times you've watched the Blue Jays or sort of paid attention to the Blue Jays, like, what do you see from them this year? What do you think they are at the moment?
I think they are the team right now that's figuring out who's going to actually be a core part of this organization going forward and on whom they can rely. Is Teoscar Hernandez's power that he's shown thus far going to make him an integral part of this lineup, or because he's 27 years old, is he somebody who you gotta look at right field for the future and say he's, you know, maybe he's like a fifth guy on a championship team, but he's probably not a third guy on a championship team. I think you look at Bo Bichette and say, we have a freaking superstar here, and this is the guy, not Vlad Guerrero Jr., around whom we're going to build. With Vladdy, I think you look at him and say, okay, you know, you see Ronald Acuna, number one prospect in baseball, come up and set the world on fire. You see Fernando Tatis Jr., number two prospect in baseball by most accounts behind Vladdy, come up and set the world on fire. What is it that is impeding Vladimir Guerrero Jr. from doing that, and how do we address that? And that's not a bad conversation to have to have. You know, with Nate Pearson, we've seen him look brilliant. We've seen him look like he looked yesterday. How do we derive more brilliance out of him, and how do we make that a consistent thing? These are questions that every organization, Richard, is asking itself. but ones that are particularly pertinent, I think, for an organization like the Blue Jays that believes it is in a position to transition into winning, not just this year, but in the coming years as well. And as we know, you know, these windows are not, you know, these windows are finite. We've seen it with the Cubs, and the Cubs this year are looking more like the Cubs that we expected after 2016. Like, it's almost like they took a three-year nap before showing up again. And, you know, with Chris Bryant's free agency, you know, a year away, and with Anthony Rizzo's contract running out, with Javier Baez a year, like, there are a lot of questions about what the Cubs' future is going to look like. And this is sort of the end of that five-year window of contention that they had after that first World Series championship.
Jeff, one of the things I'm wondering with Nate Pearson is, you know, look, you're right. He's had one start where he was really good, and he's had a couple of starts where he's given up first-inning home runs. Yesterday, for whatever reason, he stopped throwing his fastball and started attacking Francisco Cervelli with 2-0 and 3-0 sliders. What would you do? He's got a start coming up against the Orioles. Let's say that start just kind of is meh. It's okay. Now, obviously, you're going to keep running him out. But at some point, what do you do with him if you're the Jays and you get a couple of outings where he lasts 2 1/3 innings, throws 66 pitches, half of them for strikes? You know, do you put him in the bullpen? Do you piggyback him? Clearly, you can't send him down to the minors. This, to me, I think would have to be a concern for the Blue Jays, especially when it comes to pitching. What would you do?
I ride it out, Jeff. Nate Pearson is turning 24 years old within the next week. He is a starting pitcher. He is going to be a starting pitcher just because he does not have the sort of immediate success that you would hope for or expect from a guy of his pedigree and with his stuff. Doesn't mean that you pull the ripcord after a short number of starts, especially with as few innings as he's going to have to throw this season. You want him to be built up as much as he can be going into next year, when you hope you're going to play 162 games and you see him making 33 starts. I don't change a single thing, even if the outcomes have been suboptimal.
Jeff, I know the answer is going to be no to this, but, you know, I ask anyway. I love the rule, the 10th inning rule with a man on second base. I think it's just so interesting. It creates so much strategy. It makes the game exciting. And quite frankly, it could end the game quick, which all these networks, of course, want, because, you know, we live in an instant gratification. Let's get these games in as quick a window as possible. That said, for that to be permanent would be that, I got to be honest, that would be a ballsy move by the Players Association and the commissioner's office. Can you just sort of ballpark me what percentage is even possible that can continue heading forward? And it's totally anecdotal, but I really feel, I wonder if Blair agrees with me, that, like, I think more fans than not like this rule change.
I love it, and I think you're right. My reaction in social media whenever we've seen it happen a lot with the Blue Jays. One, it's why can't Charlie manage in the late innings, which you expect from fans. Two, I think, Jeff, I think people love it. I mean, I did not want to like it. I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah, I know my 12-year-old son loves it. I'm still not there. It just feels antithetical to the game for me. And I don't know if you guys saw Joe Sheehan, who does a great baseball newsletter, wrote about it. I think it was yesterday. And I thought the most interesting point that he made was, if you go back and look at every half inning in baseball this year, 4% of them have started off with a leadoff double. And what you're essentially doing is putting a runner on second base as if he had a leadoff double, or as if he walked or singled and stole second base. You're automatically giving him that. I don't think there's anything in baseball that is automatically given without reason or cause. And with it being as difficult as it is, I alluded to this earlier, guys, batting average in baseball is .235 this year. As difficult as it is for players to get on base right now, putting somebody on second instantaneously for no particularly good reason just runs against the game. But it's difficult to deny that it does
bring action. I guess my question is more of a logical one. If we're going to arbitrarily put runners on base, why are we doing it starting in the 10th inning? Why don't we do it in the 9th? Why don't we do it in the 8th? Why don't we juice the action earlier? Why don't we do it every inning? What's preventing? I'm not saying that this is a Pandora's box, that this is a slippery slope or anything like that. I'm just wondering why the 10th? Why extras? And if you're and if you are going to do that, what sorts of other changes? You know, Joe said something that made me chuckle. He's like, you know, if we're just going to be changing the dynamics of the game when we get to extra innings, why don't we just have, you know, six fielders? Why don't you, like, just take off a fielder? Maybe you do it in the infield. Maybe you do it in the outfield. You know, if we want to talk about strategy, that's interesting strategy right there. And it's almost like the four-on-four overtime in hockey. You know, you take a guy off the ice and it definitely becomes different. The difference there, though, is that
people love the four-on-four pass, and you just killed your own argument.
Listen, Richard, I love the four-on-four, but four-on-four hockey is something that has existed when you have a guy in the penalty box from both teams. Like, we've seen four-on-four hockey before. That's not something that's entirely foreign to the sport.
Good point.
Yeah, and we have never seen the two-run leadoff homer before, have we?
Right, exactly. We've never seen, like the unearned run without an error or a catcher's interference or, a pass ball, something like that. It's just weird. Like the whole thing is weird. But if you look at a baseball game, guys, and you say, what would you rather as a fan have? No outs, no runners on base, or no outs and a runner on second base, you're a crazy person if you go for the first one.
Fair. No, listen, I wanted to hate it as much as I wanted to hate expanded playoffs and everything. I wonder, though, Jeff, if maybe where this isn't going, and this is not an original thought, is, and again, this kind of philosophically might even be drive people around the bend even more. Play the 10th inning as if it's a regular inning, then use the extra runner starting in the 11th inning. I've heard some people suggest that. I don't know if that necessarily addresses it, but
I was going to say, I don't think that changes. I had a very, very interesting conversation with a high-ranking official yesterday. And it was about Major League Baseball's desire and appetite to take some of these changes that we're seeing this year, use this as a test, and just make them permanent. I don't think, Richard, what you said is entirely far-fetched. I don't think that the answer is no, that this is a one-year experiment that we're not going to see. There's a feeling throughout baseball that not only is the runner on second to begin extra innings something that's going to stick around, but that seven-inning doubleheaders are the same. And if you've opened the Pandora's box for seven-inning doubleheaders, how far away are we from seven-inning games? And I'm genuinely curious, guys, what you've thought of seven-inning games, because as much as a baseball purist as I may be, as much as it pains me to say that something like this would affect, let's say, like the individual records that baseball holds so dear, I kind of like seven-inning games. I like being in and out in 2.5 hours as opposed to three. I think there is a very large psychological barrier with fans when it comes to committing 3 hours to something every single night. The NFL is 3 to 3.5 hours. It's a one-day-a-week commitment to that. Baseball is 3 to 3.5 hours, and it is a 6 or 7 day-a-week commitment. And as this person said to me, what seven-inning games does is it addresses the problem. It doesn't address the cause. And that's a reasonable take to have. But my question back to him is, okay, then, how do you address the cause of this? Because the cause of this, and I'm sorry to get really philosophical here, but this to me is at the root of everything with baseball these days that is problematic, troublesome, and difficult to comprehend. The problem comes from the fact that they have figured out the game. The people who are in charge and the people who are on the field have recognized that strikeouts are at a premium, and that the less that the ball is in play, the likelier you are to prevent runs. They've recognized that velocity it works. It is the most effective way to shut down hitters. And so velocity guys all the way down to the youth level has been incentivized to the point where right now kids care more about throwing hard than learning how to pitch. And I don't mean to sound like a fuddy-duddy by saying that. It doesn't bother me all that much. I love watching Nate Pearson, hit triple digits on the radar gun, and the idea that he wants to be the first person to throw 106 miles per hour. But it has led to a much different game where you now have 3 minutes, I believe, and 42 seconds between balls in play on average in baseball. That is a long time without action. And when people call Major League Baseball boring, that's why. So what can you do to disincentivize something that works? That's why baseball finds itself in such a conundrum, because it's found the optimal way to play the game in terms of winning, but to play the game in terms of winning has led to a worse product. And, man, that is a hard thing to wrap your mind around if you're Major League Baseball.
No, it really is. And I'd like to know who your source was, because for your conversation, because about a week after baseball, or a couple of days after baseball, announced that they were going to go to seven-inning doubleheaders. I mean, I've been hammering the drum. I would prefer to have fewer games in baseball. I'd like to drag the regular season back to 152 or 154 games. This front office executive who used to, has always kind of bugged me about this, because he said, "Look, don't be an idiot. The owners aren't going to kiss away those extra games of revenue." Came back to me and said, "Okay, the owners will like this. The owners would love 7-inning games because they're still going to get all their revenue. You're going to have the 162 games. You're going to get 162 games worth of revenue, but you're not going to get the drain on the pitchers that you would get." I mean, it's just interesting. I hope it doesn't happen, because I like nine. I like 9 innings. 9 seems right to me. I don't know why.
Nine seems right. Jeff, 9 seems right because it's what you know. But
that's
but
true.
The seven-inning game, the game that theoretically, hopefully, would put more emphasis on the starting pitcher and allow for more complete games, the seven-inning game that automatically creates more urgency, the same thing that you said you like about the runner starting on second in the 10th
That's
inning.
That's fair. Yeah.
I mean, there are definitely some things in favor of seven-inning games, and I don't want to ignore the detriments of them, because I feel like when I make an argument in favor of 7-inning games, guys, that I am advocating for less baseball, and less baseball in my mind is never a good thing. But maybe sometimes less is more. Sometimes it is.
Mr. Passan, we're going to let you scoot. Great conversation as always. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, boys. You do the same.
Jeff Passan, our MLB insider with ESPN. I don't know. I mean, I can honestly see, Richard, I've felt all along that the stuff we see, I'm a big believer, especially in baseball, it comes to the genie in the bottle. When the genie's out, you don't put it back in. Like, I think everything we're seeing right now is going to be around. I think the DH, I don't think there's any doubt that the DH is going to be around for the rest of baseball history. I don't think there's any doubt that the extra inning rule is going to be around. Now 7-inning games, again, do the numbers. If you're an owner, you're still getting 162 games. You are keeping your stadium open less long or shorter period of time. So theoretically, you're saving money on power and stuff like that. And, maybe you can, as it is right now in a lot of places, concessions start shutting down in the seventh inning. So you've basically got 2 innings of your game where you're not going to be able to get your full service. So maybe now, you have full, maybe now you're maximizing revenue per minute, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
I think the one thing about baseball, Jeff, and I know we got to roll, so I'll be quick. Passan makes a great point about how fans are so tied to the records. But if you ever step back for a second, it's all a mirage. The records exist where black players were not allowed to play for the first you know, however many years of baseball. The mound changed, obviously, in terms of
steroids.
The height in the 60s. The steroid era changed both individual single season records as well as career records. So, and then you have the DH. So to me, that's always been a canard, Jeff. Like one thing that I think sports fans probably don't get credit for in every sport, they will adapt very quickly to rule changes.
Yes.
And so I think if you make rule changes quick, just look at the NFL. We used to slog out overtime all the time, right? Now you have this rule where, like, if a team scores a touchdown first, they win. If a team gets a field goal first, the other team gets it. Sports fans will adapt to stuff. So I think baseball, same thing.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think sports fans are very, very good and very comfortable putting stuff in context. I have no doubt about that. Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider with Tavia Sports. Some difficult news out of the NHL bubble today. Claude Julien, the head coach of the Montreal Canadiens, will not be behind the bench for the rest of the series. He was taken to hospital with chest pains following last night's game. We'll get the latest on Claude Julien's status from Ren Lavoie. Writer's Block continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Reminder that starting Monday, you could score a 70-inch LG UHD TV from Brentview Electronics. You can create the best seat in the house right at home with this Bluetooth-capable flat screen. It's got 4K active HDR, ultra surround sound, and so much more. Now to enter, collect the secret seats at 7:55, 12:55, and 4:55 every day. Then listen to Tim and Sid to qualify. You can listen in on Monday and find details at sportsnet.ca/590. I just had a text exchange, Richard, with a listener reminding me that liquor sales stop after seventh inning of games and during the seventh inning stretch. But my point was that if you're only playing seven inning games, I guess theoretically you could stop liquor sales after five innings if you wanted to be a good corporate citizen. But it gets to the point that as it stands right now, you're basically playing a quarter of your baseball game where you're paying concession staff, you're paying support staff, and you're not generating as much revenue as you could during that final inning and a half. So I guess theoretically, if you wanted to keep liquor sales going throughout the whole game, if you shut it down after seven innings, you're making more money per minute having your game open.
The one thing about the seventh inning one, like doubleheaders, I think I could totally see that. If they ever do doubleheaders, and usually they don't schedule them anymore, but seven inning doubleheaders I can buy. I am very suspect if the Major League Baseball fan, how they would react to having two innings of play taken away, given the ticket prices that they're paying. I think the networks would love it. But you know what I'm saying, Jeff? It's one thing to change rules. It's another thing to take away, like, the experience part of the experience. And that, I don't know. I mean, I'm just spitballing my own thoughts. That is one I'm not so sure baseball fans would love, just to guess.
It's a good point. And I presume there will be people out there saying, well, if you're going to take those innings away from us, then please don't charge me as much for my ticket.
Exactly. Lower the prices.
Be interesting having that conversation. Ren Lavoie is our NHL insider with Tavia Sports. He is at the bubble. He's not in it. Well, he might be in the bubble. He joins us on Writer's Block. Ren, thanks so much for doing this. First question, what is the latest on Claude Julien? And we're led to believe it's not COVID-19 related. He is in hospital after suffering chest pains. But what's the latest on Claude Julien?
Well, what I've been told is there's no reason to be concerned right now. And Mark Bergevin, the GM, alluded a little bit, in his press conference, saying that he received some good news earlier this afternoon. So that's really a positive sign, let's be honest. The last thing that you want to know, want to hear is, a major heart attack or whatever it was. They're not using the word heart attack, which means that we can't say that that's exactly what happened. It's really chest pain. So there's some positive here. He's still at the hospital, as as of right now. So you have to expect that the Canadians are going to release a statement somewhere tomorrow to tell the world what's really the next step here. Because, as you know, when you're getting out of the bubble, there's a minimum of 4 days that you have to stay in your hotel room, and you can't go anywhere. Like, you really need to stay there. So Claude's not going to coach again versus the Flyers. The question is, too, is it's a minimum of 4 days, but if you're spending, I don't know, 1, 2, or 3 days at the hospital, it could be way more than 4 days. So there's a decision to be made here. But, you know, who cares, really? What's really important right now is that Claude's health is good, that he's going to be okay, and that was just an episode, and, you know, he can be back behind a bench, I'll say, as soon as possible, but as safe as possible at the same time.
Ren, what did you make of that first game between the Canadians and Flyers?
Oh, my God. Great game. You know what? The Flyers, and I hate to use that word, but they were lucky. They were really lucky. But if the Montreal Canadiens players that had all their scoring chances, and I'm talking a little bit more about Arturi Lehkonen here. Arturi Lehkonen is the type of guy who's going to have grade A chances every game. Can't score. Can't finish. If he was a finisher, the Montreal Canadiens would have won that game. That's the reality. Kudos to Lehkonen. He's working really hard. But like I mentioned, he's not a finisher. I'm not sure he's going to score 20, 25 goals per season. But with all his scoring chances, he could easily score 30. It's not going to happen. But he's working really hard. So that's what I think about that game. I think the Flyers in the second period, they fell asleep. It happens to the Pittsburgh Penguins. In the third game of the qualifying, in the fourth game, they didn't play. So if you're sleeping versus a team like the Montreal Canadiens, you're going to get burned. And that the Flyers were really close to get burned last night. So, they are the better team, but they better wake up. And quickly, because if they're still playing like that, the Canadiens still have a chance.
Ren, let me throw something out there at you. I mean, obviously, you know, there will be people who will be wondering whether or not the Canadiens wouldn't be better off getting ready to pick Alexis Lafreniere as opposed to still being in the playoffs. I've watched, from what I've seen, you've seen this Canadiens team more than I have, so you would be in a better position to judge how far along they've gone. But from what I saw from them against the Philadelphia Flyers, and from what I saw from them leading up to this series, Ren, I think this is probably the best thing for this group of players to have a little bit of success. More than having Alexis Lafreniere. I could be wrong, but I'd rather have Max Domi and these guys and Nick Suzuki experience a little bit of success.
Yep. Yeah, and you know what? I'm with you. And probably that if you were talking right now to Martin Bergevin, the GM, he would have said exactly the same thing. And you're right, because learning to win is really important here. You watch so many teams with great players. You look at the Buffalo Sabres. They have talent, but you can't win. They're always at a funk. They can't go in the playoffs. Whoever's in the lineup, the Edmonton Oilers, I mean, you watch the Oilers, they have tons of talent. Yes, they're in the playoffs, they're getting out in the first round. Toronto Maple Leafs, I mean, come on. They're supposed to be better than that. You're looking to teams right now in the NHL, the expectations are really high, and they're not doing anything with it. And you have a team like the Montreal Canadiens, obviously, I still think that they're, I'm going to use the word far away from Toronto, but are they really that far? But if you look at, you know, the rosters, maybe you're saying to yourself, well, Montreal, they don't have Austin Matthews. They don't have all the, you know, the good forwards that the Leafs has right now. So, I mean, you look at the Canadiens and you look at the roster and you're saying to yourself, this is not a great roster. But if you really watch the games and you look at the guy like Suzuki, oh, my God. that guy is the future of that franchise. He's already the number one centerman. He's doing some great things on the ice. He hit the crossbar with a few seconds left, tied a game last night. I mean, he's the real deal. And what a great trade by Mark Bergevin to get that player and Thomas Tatar, plus a second round pick for Max Pacioretty. And by saying that, it's nothing against Max Pacioretty. I believe he's a really good player. But it's just that if you had that young centerman coming up in your team and playing like that in his rookie year, the future is going to be bright. So, and he's really, really smart. He's got some Patrice Bergeron in his game at the same time. So there's a lot of good things, and I'm with you. Learning to win and battle versus good teams like the Flyers is really going to help the Montreal Canadiens in the long run.
Ren, yesterday here in Toronto, we had the postmortem of the Leafs season with the various Leafs officials and players answering questions from the media. Naturally, of course, that as I'm sure it would be the same in Montreal, it was a good, you know, a 24-hour discussion and reading people's body language, etc.
Yeah.
You know, one of the big discussion points I think we're going to be talking about, it feels like forever, is not that the team has to be changed, which is obvious, but how the team will be changed. And do you go really big by dealing a William Nylander or a Mitch Marner, or is there a way to sort of shore up the D with some smaller moves? From your perspective, looking at Toronto as an outsider, what do you think Kyle Dubas and Brendan Shanahan can do? And is there a fix here to turn this team from, you know, a first-round loser into a deep run in the Eastern Conference?
And that's a great question. I think a guy that can really help is Pietrangelo with the Blues. He's going to be UFA. If the Leafs can find a way to get that guy, won a Stanley Cup, I really believe that he wants to play for the Maple Leafs at one point in his career. If you get Alex Pietrangelo, maybe things are going to turn. They need players that know, they know how to win. And at the same time, I'm looking at the Maple Leafs, I'm saying this to myself. Don't panic. They're still young, right? The core players, you look at them, they're really young. It's not like they're 28 years old or past their prime. They're not even close to that right now, but they're getting there. They're learning hard lessons. So I wouldn't do something drastic, to be honest with you. But if I have a chance to get a guy like Alex Pietrangelo in my lineup, obviously you need to make room at one point. You need to sacrifice maybe one player to say and get something in return, at the same time. For me, it's William Nylander. It's always been William Nylander, not because I don't think he's a good player. I really believe he's a good player. But there's too many forwards. That's no breaking news here. Too many forwards on that team making too much money, okay? So, and I'm looking at the cap the way it is. You can't pay players $10 million per season. I mean, yes, you can, but there's one guy who needs to go here. And that move, I believe, should have been done not last season. It should have been done before he signed his contract with the Toronto Maple Leafs. He signed his contract on December 1st, 2 years ago, and he didn't finish the season well. So there was a lot of wasting time right there and energy. So it should have been done 2 years ago. And the day that's going to happen, I think, I'm not saying the Maple Leafs suddenly are going to be a Stanley Cup contender, but that move will help the team to move forward if they get something really important in return, if they get the player that they want, a greedy player, and if they can sign a defenseman like Alex Pietrangelo. I know it's maybe, if you look at, you know, the cap right now, it's maybe, and maybe I'm only dreaming here.
Ren, we got to scoot, Ren.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay,
sorry,
appreciate you doing this.
Much.
No worries. Take care. We'll talk to you later. Ren LaVar, NHL insider with TVS Sports. We'll get you set for Tim and Sid. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.